And welcome everybody to the employer webinar. I'm just going to do a brief setup and then we'll get into the details. As you can see on the screen, we've got Tim and Scott with us, and they're going to go through a really compelling case study of, you know, how to do it right. You know, and I often say the best way to slash healthcare costs is to improve benefits, and they've done that. And really a pretty dramatic reduction in their spend over the last 3 to 4 years that we'll talk about. I believe we're talking about essentially halving their healthcare spending. And I'll have them give an overview of the company, kind of where employees are, and then we'll get into kind of, you know, what drove some of what they're doing, you know, how they got through it. Of course, there's always challenges anytime you have change. What were some of the key successes, how they got people on board, and then, you know, kind of wrap it up and then jump into some questions. So that's basically the plan. So why don't we start with Tim and Scott? If you could, Scott Haas is the advisor who works with Tim. He's part of the Health Rosetta program, deeply experienced in high performance benefits. And so why don't you two guys kind of give a little overview of the company, the size of the plan, the number of employees, and kind of, you know, the highlights of what happened. And then we'll get into a little of the detail on you know, some of the challenges and whatnot. So you don't have to go through all that, but just give that kind of high level overview. So thanks again for joining us, Tim and Scott, and look forward to hearing your story.
Okay, well, Pacific Steel and Recycling actually is a company that began in Spokane, Washington about 1885. Ended up working through as a hide and fur company, and then in the teens and 20s of the 1900s kind of moved into scrap material, and then continued to grow in the scrap iron area, began steel service centers in 1960. And then we are an ESOP company, 100% owned ESOP company. The original owners believed in ownership and ultimately bought them out with the ESOP back in about 1988 and 1991. So that's a real brief history of the company. Our primary businesses now are our recycling materials, whether it's scrap iron, copper, aluminum, and we also have steel service centers that sell new steel. We're able to cut, bend, punch holes in whatever we need to do relative to what we call first line processing for folks. So that's brief review of the company. We are in headquartered in Great Falls, Montana. We have 44 operations in 9 states and 1 up in Alberta, Canada. We average around 800 employees year in and year out. Now, we're a cyclical business. We're also a commodity business. So at times we're around 700 employees, and other times we're around 900. So we basically say we have 800 employees. Our largest operation has about 50 employees, and our smallest one has 2. So we have a diverse geography, which certainly impacts the health plan and some of the things that we've worked with Scott on. So with that, that's kind of a brief background on our company.
Great. Scott, why don't you give a little overview of your role and kind of jumping in and kind of the high points on what's happened over the last few years, and then we'll get into some more detail.
Yeah, so our relationship with Pacific Steel began in October of 2015. While I'm part of USI Insurance Services, I was part of a national healthcare consulting practice and still am within USI, but I was Legacy Wells Fargo Insurance. And Pacific Steel's had a long-term relationship, banking-wise, with Wells Fargo. And we essentially got a phone call from one of the bankers saying, you know, this client needs a lot of help. They began a reference-based pricing strategy January 1 of 2014. And the TPA at the time and the reference-based pricing entity at the time were ill prepared, I would say, to really execute the program. I'm not sure if that was their first one together, but immediately there was a lot of operational problems. The mechanics of the coordination between the organizations was not going well. So that was the beginning of the reference-based pricing strategy. Again, was January 1, 2014. There was a TPA switch January 1 of 2015 that, it was hopeful, I believe, by making that decision that some of the mechanical and operational issues would resolve themselves. But if anything, it actually aggravated and made the situation worse. So when we got involved in October of 2015, it was really like jumping on a merry-go-round that was spinning at about 100 miles an hour and just holding on, trying to figure out, you know, what issue to identify first and really start working through, what we were observing as challenges that ranged all the way from, the member perhaps not totally understanding the whole plan and their role and Pacific Steel's commitment to the plan. I think a lot of it, the providers within the very vast geographic spread of this group were all of a sudden starting to wake up to the fact that, hold it, we just got paid something that's different from what we would typically observe in a PPO environment. And there began to be quite a bit of balance bill disruptions. There was one hospital in southeastern Idaho that actually took a number of claims that were, I want to say, about 9 months old and actually sent back to the company something in the range of like $650,000 of claims and then direct billed the patients directly. Which, if you think about that, wasn't really very smart, but, it is what they did. So there were just issues all about, but most of which, I think the biggest problems that we identified was the operational mechanics between the reference-based pricing organization, the member advocacy piece, and then the TPA itself. It was just, not a smooth functioning environment. The other thing that we did, we're a data-driven consulting practice. We went out, we got all the data, not only from the prior TPA, the original TPA that basically bridged the PPO to the reference-based pricing strategy 1114, but we also got it all from the current TPA. And what we did is essentially began going back and looking at that data. We repriced everything back to Medicare allowed so that we could determine and begin to audit, really what was going on from a contractual integrity perspective of how well these claims were truly being repriced and how well they were being adjudicated. And as we started to identify those issues, then it put us in a position to begin looking at either one, how do we begin to address with the current service providers, how to fix this. Or ultimately what we ended up doing is we created within a very unique partnership arrangement what we term as a second generation of reference-based pricing. And that strategy actually went in place January 1 of 2018. So from a historical perspective, that was, on that piece. Interestingly enough, we do a lot of PBM consulting, and we actually created a PBM solution for Pacific Steel, which went into place January 1 of 2014, before our consulting team was actually brought in as the broker of record in 2015. So we had a brief, I think a pretty good idea of who Pacific Steel was and some of their challenges, but we were supporting another broker in that regard on just the PBM piece. So it also made that transition, I think, a little more effective for us because we really knew the client at that point.
Great. Hey, Scott, there's some folks on this that probably don't even know what reference-based pricing is. We've gotten pretty familiar with it. Can you give just kind of a brief overview of what reference-based pricing is? Within the Health Rosetta framework, we do reference-based pricing as kind of the bridge to transparent open networks, which is essentially the successor to PPOs. PPOs may have served their purpose at one time, but unfortunately have really lost their value in terms of the way they're implemented. So, Scott, if you don't mind, I guess doing two things. One, explain reference-based pricing, and to the extent you and Tim can share it, give us just what Pacific Steel was essentially spending on health benefits, say 4 years ago, and what it's spending today, you know, either in dollar terms or in percent reduction. It'd be great to get that.
Yeah, so I look at the term reference-based pricing to be a subset of a overall category that our consulting practice has coined, that we refer to this reference-based pricing as a subset of alternative reimbursement methodology. So what we're saying is that in the realm of an alternative reimbursement methodology, what we're referring to is something other than PPO, which I think everybody on the line understands what a preferred provider organization is. But when we look at alternative reimbursement, we look at reference-based pricing as one component, and essentially there's really not a formal definition, but in an operational perspective in the marketplace, reference-based pricing is using something other than a direct contract, a PPO contract, to determine what the allowable amount is that will be paid and adjudicated by the plan. And really it's based on more of a cost plus model from a bottom up versus a PPO discount model, which is from a retail price down. So in the marketplace, there's various versions of reference-based pricing. Depending on the particular vendor that you're working with, it actually does the claims repricing itself. And then also, you know, how their form of employee advocacy is structured. Technically, you know, the reference-based pricing piece is moving into the marketplace without a network or in a modified network environment. And what I mean by that is that there's one model that you can lease a provider-only panel from a national PPO network. That goes a long way to basically reduce a lot of the member disruption, because your highest utilization typically is in the provider component. And then that type of model then establishes a reference-based price, typically the Medicare allowed of some percentage, that is really focused on the facility claims, both inpatient and outpatient, which technically is where I think most of the money and abusive pricing practices rest. In addition to reference-based pricing, we also, our practice for a number of years, we do a lot of case rate negotiations on surgeries, where we'll work with the plan sponsors and the medical management companies and the TPAs that will defer certain types of claims to us on the pre-certification or the prior authorization basis. We would look at that, and we would essentially go out and look and negotiate for surgical case rates that were at a even lower relationship than what most reference-based pricing plans are achieving. So for example, we had a claim in Pocatello, Idaho, that the surgeon, the facility, and the anesthesiologist appliance, the PPO allowed would have been right at about $68,000, which is what the hospital was proposing. And we ultimately ended up moving that to a standalone ambulatory surgical center with a very high quality rating and a very good surgeon, where we flew the member up to Spokane, got them into the Coeur d'Alene, Idaho area. All in, even with travel and per diem, it was about $25,000, you know, on a fixed cost basis. In exchange, we typically waive out of pocket to the member, because the providers don't want to be chasing accounts receivable if they're going to give you that type of a price. And then second of all, we pay for those types of episodic case rates at the point of service. Other types of things that we're doing is we're really using the reference-based pricing as a methodology to get to a direct contract. I personally don't look at reference-based pricing as a long-term strategy that you plug it in and that's your plan. We look at it as a methodology to create enough disruption that it creates a positive opportunity to have discussion between self-insured plan sponsors and the health systems in their local communities that are serving their employees and their families. There's a few other types of alternative reimbursements, but I think those are some of the key areas.
Great, and real quick, Can you just recap, and maybe we'll go two parts on this. One is what sort of reduction in spending that's happened for Pacific Steel, but probably the compelling part is something we call the Health Rosetta Dividend, which is, you know, essentially there, you know, it's well documented, the Institute of Medicine and PricewaterhouseCoopers, PwC, have both said between $750 billion and $1 trillion of our healthcare spending in this country adds no value, is waste. And so the good news in that is there's a lot of money sloshing around in healthcare that can go to higher and better purposes. And so that's what we call the Health Rosetta Dividend, when you can take money that's been previously squandered, put it into, it could be workers' wages, it could be better benefits, it could be profit sharing, it could be R&D. You know, it's going to depend on the organization. But two things. One is, tell me what that reduction has been. And then you both shared a story about a longtime worker and, you know, modest income and what that meant in terms of retirement. We know that, you know, most people have no savings for retirement at all to speak of. And you know, over half of households have less than $1,000 in savings, you know, believe it or not. And so tell a little bit of that story. To me, that's kind of the why behind all this. Like, why would you go through this? Of course, it's nice to save money, but what is the actual human impact? So if you could start with the reduction and then how we, you know, can kind of reallocate previously squandered money.
Yeah, so I'll start with the actual plan metrics, and then Tim, I'll defer to him on the personal issues. At a high level, moving from the PPO environment to the reference-based pricing environment all the way through to where we are today at the plan year ending December 31st, 2018, and these are high-level numbers, but the plan moved essentially from spending right at about $8 million a year. And in this last year ending 2018, I believe we were right at about $3.2 million. So very little change in plan design. You know, it's a lot of the effectiveness of the pricing and I think squeezing a lot of that excess out. But over that period of time, we not only had that substantial of a reduction in the overall medical claims costs, but during the period of all this, we've really settled down the disruption between the providers, the hospitals, and the members. One of the things that we did is, and it was part of the learning process of the data analytics we did, is, you know, the previous our, you know, reference-based pricing vendor that was doing the repricing, they came in and they plugged in everything at like 160% of Medicare allowed, you know, not unreasonable compared to some of the others that are out there at 120% or, you know, 115% cost of charge, you know, however they determine that allowable. But one of the things that we did that I think has really gone a long ways to settling down the disruption in the marketplace for both the employees and the providers is that we created an allowable fee schedule that's based on the point of service and the type of service. So depending upon the type of service and where that service is delivered, the allowable varies, you know, all the way from E&M codes, which are priced out at one level versus lab that's priced out at a different level versus outpatient that's at a different level or inpatient is at a different level. And the reason we did that is we found that there were certain price points at which the providers would not balance bill and the facilities themselves would not balance bill, and they were more likely to accept what, you know, what was paid. And the other part is we felt it was more fair and equitable between both parties. Now, it doesn't mean that we don't have balance billing activity going on. We do, but it's majorly diminished. And then the negotiation process has resulted and a very minimal additional payment by the plan sponsor to negotiate final settlement of those claims. I think in 2018, the plan paid an additional $6,600 to basically settle those balance bills. So it's really gone a long way to removing that disruption from the members and the families that are involved in that. So Tim, I'll let you talk more about the other side of the question.
Well, want to give just a smidge more background from what Scott had indicated, and then I'll get into the personal side of it. We, like a lot of companies, were fully insured till the mid-2000s, and then we moved to a self-funded plan. And that was able to allow us to analyze and control costs better. We were able to see where some of the significant charges are. And as Scott mentioned, in 2013, we saw a spike in facility costs that was just astronomical. And so that's really what prompted us to move into the reference-based repricing. So when we met with the providers we originally went with, we actually really did like the concept of being able to do a reference-based repricing situation. It made a lot of sense to us. But again, you're looking at a pretty significant change from moving a self-funded PPO-style plan to totally doing away with the PPO network. Unfortunately for us, the original TPA indicated they could do some stuff, and the original folks in the repricing area and also indicated they could do some things, and we obviously weren't as successful in that area. So we knew it was going to be disruptive to our employees to begin with. So once we as the executive team made the decision to go forward with this process, we went out to all of our branches, and we actually went out in December, and we didn't have one of the nicer winters in Montana and Idaho, to make this presentation to all of our employees, because we said this is going to have a disruption. You now need to become a better consumer of our medical spend. But Dave, as we talked about, we are an ESOP company, 100% owned. So one of the things we were able to do, an ESOP company, the performance of the company will determine what the share price is because we're valued each year, and then that really goes to what the retirement program is going to look like for each employee. So we sort of made a direct link between a healthcare spend dollar and a retiree dollar. And we basically said to them, we can either spend it for healthcare, whatever that is, somebody's other retirement program, for a hospital CEO, for example, or we can spend it to reduce our costs by you being more involved and then translate that into their performance for the company, which results in higher retirement benefit. So that's the linkage that we made. The unfortunate thing for us, Scott alluded to, is we just didn't have the right providers. The other thing that kind of happened to us is, as the CEO and myself, who were primary decision makers and recommenders of this, thought once we got this all lined up, the professional service providers would handle all of it. Well, we found out that we needed to remain more engaged than we were. And how we found that out was we have a branch manager meeting a couple of times a year, and about June of 15, so we've been on the program about a year and a half. We got reamed pretty good by our branch managers for the employee impact of this program. So what we did to minimize that at that point in time is, first of all, our CEO and myself got much more intricately involved in working with all of the providers. We had a monthly conference call and went through the issues that we were having. So that was kind of number one. Obviously, getting Scott involved helped us streamline this and get a better focus on the program. But most importantly, what we did is we brought somebody in to do nothing but handle our employee concerns and questions. So she had a background with Blue Cross Blue Shield, and we brought her on, and her job remains full-time to coordinate with our employees, the service providers, and the health providers to smooth that out. So we were able to put a lot of the employee headaches and problems away. Now, one of the things we did require of our employees, as Scott alluded to in the balanced billing area, because that is a big concern, is that if they did their things right, in other words, if they prepared the paperwork that they needed to, if they got a balanced bill, got it to us on a timely basis and did their work, we guaranteed them that we would not allow them to go bankrupt because of a balanced bill or have a credit issue related to that. So anytime an employee has actually done what they are required to do and perform, then we've been able to, we've helped them out. So we've had a few employees though that goes, they just decided that they weren't going to do anything in that area. And unfortunately for a few of them, there wasn't much we could do once we found out about the issues that we've had. So we knew it was going to be painful. We knew it was going to be disruptive. But the key linkage we've been able to make is we either spend it for healthcare or we get it into your retirement plan.
Yeah, no, I think that's a powerful point. I've heard a few folks make that point. It's like, do you want your retirement dollars to go into the hospital exec's retirement plan or your plan? And that tends to be an attention grabber. The other thing that I'll sometimes remind people of is, you know, when the issue of disruption comes up is by far, the U.S. is the undisputed world leader in medical bill-driven bankruptcy, you know, enabled by PPO networks. So there's already a tremendous amount of disruption that has created, you know, frankly, a 20-year-long economic depression for the working and middle class. Because, you know, one definition of an economic depression is two or more years of income decline. And it's not because employers aren't spending more money. They're spending far more than 20 years ago. The problem is it's all gone into healthcare. And we don't, you know, lifespans have doubled during that time. That might have been a fair trade. So another thing I'd be curious about is whether you have done anything in the pharmacy area. You know, that's kind of, it's not as big as you know, sort of the hospital bills, you know, which tends to be the biggest bucket. But certainly rising as a big challenge. And so curious, you know, if you could kind of summarize at a high level, you know, and people will provide contact information, you know, if attendees want to contact on the details. So you guys can keep it pretty high level. But if you can address whether or not you've done anything in the pharmacy area and just kind of the high points on that, that would be great.
I'm going to let Scott carry most of this, but both from the self-funded plan and from the reimbursement plan, Scott and his team are much better off to advise us on changes that we should be making relative to the structure of the reimbursement program. That's all I'm going to say relative to that. Scott is really the expert in this area, so I'll let him cover that.
Yeah, so one of the unique blessings of our consulting practice is that I'm one of three principal consultants of our consulting team. One of my partners is a certified risk manager that comes out of the managed care side. So a lot of the work that we do in that area relates to understanding healthcare risk as it relates to Medicaid, Medicare, and commercial health insurance risk, which is where your self-insured plan falls into. So, you know, we're very blessed in the fact that we have good leadership within the three of us, but we're supported by some of the probably smartest healthcare analysts I've ever worked with in my entire career. My other partner is a clinical pharmacist who has built two PBMs. And the manner in which we provide PBM consulting in the industry is not matched by any other PBM consulting practice in the country. And I can say that with 100% fact, and I can also back it up with the results that we bring to our client because of the methodology that we use. So that's probably the extent of my advertisement in that. But what we do is we have created a procurement process that's really modeled around Department of Defense procurement discipline. And if any of you've ever worked with a DOD RFP, you'll understand the rigor that requires. And it's all based upon process and how we achieve the results that we bring to our clients. And the key aspect of that process is we will never ever give a client's data to the PBMs for them to reprice and then bring back an answer that then we as consultants are expected to, you know, put on a spreadsheet and determine, you know, who's the winner and who brought the best solution back to the table. And the reason we don't do that is one is it's part of the procurement discipline, but number two, the moment that we as an organization would let a client's data go behind a third party's firewall, we have lost all ability to validate that the methodology and the results of what that organization brings back is actually has any integrity and has any validity to it. I'm not saying that the PBMs are problematic in that way, but we also do the same thing when we go out and we evaluate provider networks. We never ever give the clients data up. But the reason that's important then is that we've created a process whereby the PBMs bid on the privilege of serving our clients on a methodology that is very well structured and it's black and white. So, but the process is what drives it. So essentially what we've done is we've created a bid platform environment that has no bias. We, you know, we're commonly asked, you know, what PBMs do you guys like and all that? And the answer is, you know, we don't really have an opinion and we have no bias. We will work with any PBM that is willing to respond and meet the spirit of our procurement discipline. So that was the first step of where we actually became involved with Pacific Steel, while another Wells Fargo broker was working on the reference-based pricing side. He asked us to come in and do the PBM piece, which we did. And the initial savings, and you can kind of look at the metrics of this, but the initial savings or cost reduction that we implemented was about $200,000 in the first year. That was the actual net, you know, cost impact and reduction to Pacific Steel. And, you know, the irony is that as well structured as their PBM program is, and we continue to manage that and we, you know, put, you know, we continue to negotiate pricing on their behalf, it doesn't mean that this client or any other client is immune from specialty drug variation. So when we actually look at the metrics, we actually see a total flattening and in some cases a downward trend in the generic component. The brand component is a bit variable based, and it's all utilization driven. You know, cost-wise, it's a good cost contract. But the one thing that you or I or any consultant on this call cannot take accountability for is the utilization variance of, you know, brand and then especially specialty drug. But it's been a really positive impact. We see fluctuations in the specialty component, which really is driving at sometimes 80% of the total prescription drug cost.
Great, thanks. And you know, we're going to segue into questions pretty soon because there may be some that folks have. But would love to, Tim, if you could share, you know, if you were going to give, you know, two or three bits of advice to other employers, you know, what would you pull out as kind of the biggest sort of inflection points in your thinking?
Okay. I do want to make mention of just one other thing, Dave, that in terms of putting together provider agreements, we've got like 4,500 of them throughout our footprint. So providers, anesthesiologists, physician groups, all of those generally are favorable to it. It's a one-page agreement. So we have a lot of those. Where the challenges come in is trying to get facility agreements. And we've met with CFOs and CEOs of probably 12 hospitals over the years, and they're not very receptive to this process. But we do have seven or eight of those in place. The takeaways, though, Dave, would probably be three or four. One, certainly recognize and inform your employees that there is going to be a little bit of pain involved initially as you transition to this. Two is to really get involved in trying to find the right consultant that you can work with. Because again, we all run our businesses. We are not healthcare experts by any means. That's why you need somebody like a Scott on board with you that knows this area, not just goes out and gets contracts for fully insured or PPO programs. It really needs to know the reference-based pricing model. For us, top-line management involvement is critical, particularly at the outset, and you know, we slipped a little bit on that, but once we got back involved with that, then we were able to smooth that out. And so, and then in our case, again, having somebody solely dedicated, and that's really the total job to be for your employees, their dependents to communicate with, who can communicate with the service providers, and then who can provide, communicate with the healthcare providers, really takes a lot of headaches away from all of those groups, and then properly can work through that. So I think that those would be the key takeaways. I do want to mention one success, because Dave, you asked about employees and how they took it. We have an employee here in Great Falls that had gone to a physician group of the largest hospital here. And this would be an employee you wouldn't think would have done that. But he went to them, and this is just recent story. So the physician for that group, he needed two knee replacements, said, well, you need this. And our employee went back to them, because we have another hospital group here in town, a smaller one, but also has orthopedic services. And our employee went back to that physician and said, you guys are going to be way too expensive for me to have the knee replacement done. And we had negotiated a contract with the other hospital. Probably ended up saving the plan, I'm going to guess, somewhere in the neighborhood of $50,000 to $70,000 just recently in terms of that. And so I think from a personal story, that's where employees begin to take ownership. Is there a better way to do this, particularly for elective surgeries? Now, we're not trying to influence really where they go, but and we want to make sure they have quality outcomes. But any of these single contract ones that Scott's turned into have turned out really, really well for us in terms of knee or hip replacement procedures that we've had.
Great. Thanks, Tim. I'll just echo some of my takeaways from the conversation, and then we'll have some time for questions. Number one is, these kind of changes, they are change. My observation is they're really only risky if you don't have the right team. As Tim just mentioned, you got to hire the right consultant. If you have folks who have done these things, it's pretty similar, after you get enough of these under your belt, that it's really a straightforward process. You clearly need to educate employees and top management about it, as Tim mentioned. But that's number one. Two is there are, certainly Pacific Steel is a great example, where they dropped their spending by over half. They didn't sort of relent to the tyranny of low expectations that the best you can hope for is a less bad increase. We are regularly seeing employers spend 20 to 40% less, after a year or two. And then typically costs sort of level off after that, and everybody else sort of buys into the myth that healthcare costs go up, even though, if you talk to any doctor or nurse, they're not getting paid radically different than they were 5, 10, 20 years ago. It's basically gone into a bunch of things that actually aren't healthcare. The final thing I would say is I have ripped off something that Scott talked about briefly, which is the mindset shift. The way I look at it is every CEO I've ever spoken to will say employees are our most important asset, which is a great statement to make. However, if they are the most important asset, putting them into a healthcare system that, can bankrupt them, doesn't necessarily produce great outcomes, that's not a great way to steward the most important asset. So as Scott mentioned, these organizations, the mindset shift they've had is, hey, it is a privilege to serve our employees, and like any other area in our business, we are going to purchase value, whether, office supplies, or raw materials, or what sort of empowers our most important asset, our employees. And once you have that mindset shift, then that does turn the conversation in a different direction, and then it becomes a natural outgrowth to do the sort of things that we've talked about here. So with that, I believe we have some questions. And so Melissa will chime in with some of the questions we've gotten, and we'll try to get through as many as we can in the remaining time, but be respectful of finishing up at the top of the hour. So Tim and Scott, thanks again for participating in this, and looking forward to some of the questions we might get.
Great. And for everybody listening in, there is a Q&A option. It looks like a couple of you have found that. So if you have questions, please put that into the Q&A window. Tim, so you mentioned a little bit about negotiating with the providers and negotiating direct facilities arrangements. Barry is asking, could you speak to the challenges, pros, and cons of using RBP at all of your locations across 9 states? Does it work in all of the locations, or are some better than others? And what kinds of healthcare provider scenarios make for a viable RBP program?
I will say for the non-facility providers, we've not had a lot of issues in and around that. Of course, we work with a company that negotiates these a bit for us as well throughout that entire time period. So I would say, generally speaking, if you're looking at what I'll call non-facility providers, it's been favorable. On the other hand, in the facility area, boy, we have had the gamut of them. I mean, almost to the point of just throwing out our idea out the door in a couple of markets. Clearly more of a challenge on the facility side. And in other places, we've had really, really good luck. We have a number of places, facilities that we don't have contracts with of any kind, but yet they've honored our repricing approach and our audit of the bill approach as well. So it really does depend on the market area, and it really does depend to a large degree, what I'll say, on the administration of the hospital. And a classic example is right here in our hometown, the big behemoth hospital. Basically, we've had a real difficult time working with them. So we've gone with the smaller hospital, frankly, which is more patient friendly, in my opinion. And we've had really, really good luck working with them. So it just depends on the areas you're at and the philosophy of the administration of the facility. So I think hopefully that answers the question.
Great, thank you.
Melissa, if you don't mind, I'm going to just chime in real quick. In my recent book, I've got a case study on the Pittsburgh area schools, about 45,000 teachers in these school districts around Pittsburgh, and there's a behemoth there that's known for extremely high pricing, and they did a very thorough review of quality in that area. And despite a big reputation and big prices, they didn't have big quality in most areas. There's a couple exception areas. And so, you know, through the analysis they did and then educating the members, it came down to, again, did the teachers care about smaller class sizes, more librarians, better pay for teachers and better benefits, or the hospital execs, you know, Jaguar? And, you know, it became pretty clear that that organization wasn't going to be cooperative. And so they're essentially excluded from their network. I mean, you can go there, but you're going to pay, you know, a big chunk of it as the member. And that has really directed the volume to the high value providers. And so there needs to be a education of your members, but then there's a willingness, you know, to do that. So Melissa, go ahead.
Dave, may I make another comment along those lines?
Please.
Because I was on a self-funded panel a couple of years ago. Scott was out there with us, and we'd gone through, myself and our HR director had gone through the whole, our program and our challenges and our transition. And the final question I got was from an administrator in North Carolina, and he goes, well, you know, do you care about the employee outcome and the employee experience? And we certainly do. We don't, that isn't de-emphasized in any manner, way, shape, or form. And I should have responded that once hospitals and facilities begin to actually publish their outcomes and their prices, we would have a much better ability to be able to spend, you know, we spend more time pricing out of TV than we do a significant surgery you're going to have as just consumers. But the problem is you don't always get the outcomes, and you certainly don't get the pricing from facilities at this point.
Yeah, and I'll just add on to that. There's another advisor in our program that walked the talk personally. He had a hernia operation, and he lives in North Carolina, and priced it out, ultimately traveled to Oklahoma to a high quality center. And, you know, he was doing research on infection rates and what are called never events and things like that, where you have adverse outcomes. Unfortunately, it's 47 times safer to jump out of a plane with a parachute than it is be admitted to a hospital in terms of preventable medical mistake deaths. And, you know, when he priced it out, the most expensive facility, most expensive hospital was the one nearby him, big academic medical center that actually had a death from a hernia operation. And so, you know, he went where there was high value, and oftentimes the highest value places have the lowest prices because they do it a lot. They don't have complications. So that's not always obvious, but something we found. So thanks for chiming in, Tim and Melissa. We can go ahead and go to the next question.
Great. And Scott, I think this one may be a good one for you because you see a lot of different plans. This is from Daniel. Daniel is asking, typically with contractual relationships from employers to health providers, you need size to negotiate those relationships. The company you've highlighted today is not in a major population center where multiple insurers compete for those relationships. How does an employer in a market area of 4 million plus lives utilize your system?
So I actually dispute the concept that volume gets you better pricing in healthcare. You know, we basically, because of the fact that, you know, we have the data, as I said, one of the things that we do on any client when we first become engaged is we reprice all their claims so that we can actually do a network performance evaluation across their entire spectrum of employees and their claims. That gives you a really good insight right up front as to, you know, how well is a PPO functioning or not. And then it allows us to really start to dig in specific to where the volume providers are, both facility and by providers. But my view of where we are heading is that volume doesn't really matter, price matters. So for example, when we negotiate what we do in the PBM space, there's a perception in PBM that you have to have a large number of employees or members in order to get good pricing. And quite honestly, that's just plain false. It's about the process and it's about the methodology that you employ that basically achieves competitive pricing. And as I said earlier, one of the reasons that we don't give data out to PBMs or to networks or to carriers, and we require them to bid on the privilege of serving our client, is that it's their own competitiveness, whether it be the hospitals directly, the providers directly, or the networks or the PBMs, their ability to compete is facilitated by our process, which every time we put an RFP out, the prices go down. And it does, I mean, we have groups that are 150 employees that are self-insured that has better pricing than some of the large coalitions that we see throughout the country that have 2 and 3 million members in it. Size of population really doesn't matter. It's a matter of getting price. Now, I will say that there are some hospitals that you're going to have a really hard time getting them over their mentality that you have to have a high volume of membership in order to get better pricing. But, you know, we've been able to work around that pretty effectively because my basic belief is that a lot of these health systems are starting to come around and be more willing to negotiate directly with an employer who's creating commerce in their community than they are for a third-party insurer, PPO network, or other that essentially is part of an organization that's really not embedded in that local community. We, time after time, have been able to kind of leverage that to a point where the facilities will give us better pricing than what they actually give the large blues or the large carriers that are within their state.
Yeah,
but again, I'm an outlier in that belief, but again, part of it's because of the process and the analytics that we have in support of our efforts.
Yep, and I actually have a chapter in my book on that and some of the non-intuitive things that of that dynamic. And certainly the process that Scott mentioned is important. The other thing is, you know, the hospitals can be quite adept with the PR game in terms of making a local big employer appear to be a bully or something. And whereas when it's a smaller employer, you know, it's really the health system that's the bully in this. And when you get into the discussion of like, really, you need to charge five times what Medicare makes when, you know, Medicare, based on your own cost reporting, allows you to make money, you know, and that tends to change the discussion. So it's a longer discussion there, but it's like a lot of things in healthcare. It's not always intuitive the way it works.
Great. So Tim, Monique is asking, what data analytics do you use? What are the key metrics that you track and measure at an executive level in your business around the healthcare?
Probably a better question for Scott. We get our metrics and our data from his team there and working through the TPA, and then look to their expertise for that. Obviously, on a gross basis, we're going to clearly look at our spend level totally for our entire health program. But in terms of the specific metrics and so forth, we look to Scott for that, and then oftentimes Scott and his team will make recommendations in and around some of the metrics that we're finding there. So I might have Scott do that a little bit more. As I noted, you know, all of our jobs are not necessarily related to being experts in the healthcare area. It's getting the right people on board. So I think I'm going to pass this one off to Scott for further discussion.
Yeah, so, you know, our data warehouse and our analytics approach, we've built proprietary tools that we have that we utilize in the consultative underwriting and placement of the managed care HMO reinsurance that we work in. And that's something that's just evolved over a 25-year period. In the service providers that we've now placed Pacific Steel in, where we've moved them into what we've called a second generation type of reference-based pricing, the TPA, the repricer, and our analytics teams, we really sat down and we designed a reporting package that's really focused on identifying key metrics within the Pacific Steel environment, or for that matter, any reference-based pricing or alternative-based pricing environment that we create. So, you know, it's a lot of the standard measurements that you would look at on an incurred basis, a paid basis, tracking of large claims. But the other pieces that we really dive into is we're measuring, you know, what is the actual value of the 4,500 direct contracts that we have with providers. And then, you know, the second thing that we do is we start segmenting that into primary care and to specialists. And then we're really starting to look at, you know, how well are those direct contracts really performing? And then we tie that all into member disruption as far as, you know, are we, you know, not getting the balance bills and the disruption. The second piece then is we do dive very deeply into the what we call the MAC pricing, the maximum allowable charge, which is the reference-based pricing allowable that we now have in place that varies by type of service, place of service. So we're always looking at, you know, that performance and beginning to measure that against market norms that we see out in the marketplace. I think one of the key things that Tim had mentioned, I think Dave mentioned it also, is, you know, we've seen a trend basis where we've seen the drop and then we have utilization hits. We've had a large claim that actually attached the stop loss, which for this group is set at $225,000. And we can see the impact of that and how that has basically, you know, impacted the stop loss rates. I think one of the other key areas that we were able to achieve is by moving from the first generation of RVP to the second generation, I think one of the more profound metrics is we've actually reduced the fixed cost that the plan was paying by something in the area of $640,000 in 1 year. That's just in the fixed cost. That is not, and you know, when you take that and you start going additive to the claims cost and the different metrics that we're looking at, you know, it's pretty profound.
The other thing, though, I do want to comment that we will meet with Scott and his team and our TPA usually twice a year, just on the data and the trends that we're seeing there. And then one other time a year, we'll sit down and begin to restructure what the premiums are, both what the premiums are. In other words, what we're going to charge our branches or for each employee, and then what the employee share is going to be. So we're not ignoring that, but the metrics are a broad range of data, and then trying to structure or restructure some of the coverages that we provide, some of what we will call the deductibles or the copays associated with that. So we do get a lot of data. We do get a lot of metrics, which we do look at and discuss, and then once a year. So I don't want to say we don't look at them, we don't consider them, but we look to the experts to provide those metrics to us.
Great. Thank you so much. So Dave, I'm going to throw this one to you. Ellen is asking, do your programs include evaluation of clinical appropriateness of proposed elective surgical procedures? As we all know, so much care delivered in this country is considered unnecessary. You're certainly getting good prices, outcomes for, say, knee replacements, but what about whether or not that knee replacement was necessary in the first place?
In the interest of time, what I'll do is, because I know we only have a couple minutes and I know there's another question, I will give a broad general answer. I know that Scott and Tim have some information on kind of more details, and certainly we can make Scott available for follow-up questions. So let me address that one broadly, because that's a key question. You know, a great price on an unnecessary procedure isn't a good deal. And so, Scott, I know they've done some medical management and review. The thing that we've seen time and again is that there's a tremendous amount of over-treatment. You mentioned knee replacement. If you look at the musculoskeletal area, you know, basically joint, back, knee, shoulder, et cetera, half of the procedures being done around the country, there's no evidence behind that they're effective. And, you know, Virginia Mason and Starbucks did a study where they found that 90% of the spinal procedures that were being done didn't help at all. And to their credit, Virginia Mason is a very high quality organization. They changed their process. And so what we see, you know, lower back pain is a perfect example of how we really botch it in this country. It's the second most common reason people go to the doctor after cold and flu. It's a number one driver of disability. It's a number one driver of opioid prescriptions, even though there's no evidence that's the most effective method. So what I see time and again is when you have proper primary care, which includes things like physical therapy and whatnot, they prevent that from happening. So there's a longer answer there. I think there might be one other question we can quickly address. Melissa, is that right?
Yeah. So this one is, does the Health Rosetta network of certified agents still use traditional insurance plans?
Yeah, we have, in the year since the program launched, and we only accepted in about 8% of the folks who inquired, there's almost 4 million lives represented across many different plans, and they're fully, you know, in the full continuum. So there are still folks who are fully insured, and the advisors working with them, you know, are getting, even if they don't already have experience, we're educating them on how to make the transition. Some of them, in fact, partner up with more seasoned advisors like Scott to help make that transition. So yeah, there are advisors who work with fully insured, but we all know that your hands are really tied with that. And one of the things that's also not obvious, maybe on the surface, is even when you are fully insured, the reality is you're self-insured, because I can assure you, if you have a bad plan year, you will see big spikes in your premium. So you're already taking on the risk. It's just whether you're taking it up front or not. So there's lots of experience on those, lots of knowledge on how to make that transition. But again, to be respectful of Tim and Scott and all your time, we will wrap up. Unless there's anything final, Melissa, I think we should wrap up here, and then, you know, we'll be reachable, Tim and Scott and ourselves, and I'm happy to help anybody out.
Yeah, so just really quickly, there will be a follow-up email that comes out. If there's questions, feel free to direct those to us. And similarly, you'll see behind Dave are two books. Those are available for free as a download at healthrosetta.org/friends. So we'll share that with you. We'll also share the recording of this. And I just, Tim and Scott, I so appreciate your time this morning sharing your experiences so that other people can have similar results.
Yeah, and I just second that, and congratulations on the tremendous results and really exciting what that means for your team. So thanks again for taking time out on your Friday morning.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thank you.